Signs of life on Venus, and science on the lunar surface. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Signs of phosphine were detected in the atmosphere of Venus, alluding to signs of life on the planet. We'll speak with planetary scientist Paul Byrne about the current conversation over the discovery and how these phosphine levels could change scientists' understanding of Venus. Then, a new era of moon exploration has started. India landed its first probe at the south pole of the moon, a place NASA is targeting for its Artemis human astronaut missions. We'll speak with Barbara Cohen, a planetary scientist at NASA, about why the south pole is a focus in the upcoming lunar expeditions. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? On Earth, phosphine is generally produced by microorganisms that live in a low-oxygen environment. In 2020, phosphine was discovered in the clouds on Venus. But recently, scientists have discovered phosphine deeper in the atmosphere than they previously thought. So, how could phosphine change everything we know about the hottest planet? Here to talk more about the possible life on Venus and the controversy surrounding the findings is Paul Byrne, an associate professor of Earth, Environmental, and Planetary Sciences at University of Washington in St. Louis. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back, Brendan. How are you?
I am great, Paul, and I'm really glad to have you on because it seems like every time we have you on the show, we talk about phosphine on Venus, and this story continues to thicken and get more complex, doesn't it? What is the most recent finding when it comes to phosphine on Venus?
Okay, so just as a quick reminder, phosphine is a gas that is very common in the giant planets, say Jupiter and Saturn's atmospheres. We find it on Earth, but on Earth, it's largely, though not exclusively, made by biological activity. And so the reported detection of phosphine in Venus's atmosphere about 3 years ago in September 2020 got a lot of people in the planetary community talking because it's not a gas you would expect to find in the atmosphere of Venus. The most recent claim is that the original reporting team says that they have found, again, evidence for this strange or unusual gas deeper in the Venus atmosphere than had been reported before. But it suffice to say that I don't think this most recent reported detection is going to settle the issue.
And why is that?
Well, frankly, there's a lot of disagreement as to whether or not this is even a real detection. So the first reported detection, September 2020, by an international team led by researchers in the UK, used two different telescopes, radio telescopes on Earth. They basically reported finding very, very low amounts of this surprisingly present gas in the atmosphere of Venus. But within a few weeks, there was a lot of counterclaim by other researchers who, using the same data, but sometimes with a different way of processing it, reported that they could find no such detection at all, or that the detection was much lower than the original claim was, or even that the original group had mistaken one kind of gas, this phosphine, which is very, very rare, for perhaps actually a much more common gas, sulfur dioxide, in Venus's atmosphere, which is not a surprise, and we know is there's lots of it there. So basically, over the last 3 years, there's been sort of back and forth. And honestly, I don't think that we're going to fully resolve this issue until and if we get into the Venus atmosphere itself with state-of-the-art instrumentation to actually detect this gas and determine once and for all if it really is there.
We'll talk about the potential of that in a moment, but all of this back and forth, all of this data collection, isn't offering any sort of clarity as to what's happening there? I've got to assume that the more scientists that are looking at this, the more clarity we may get by parsing through the data, but that doesn't seem to be the case, does it?
No. That's in fact actually often how it works is that if you have five scientists in a room and you ask them for an opinion on a topic, you might get seven answers. So more scientists isn't necessarily better. The short answer is right now, if phosphine is present in the atmosphere of Venus, it's at lower amounts than was originally claimed. It may be that there is some problem in the detection in the original claim and the fact that it's not there at all. It's also possible that the amount of phosphine, if it is there, might vary both in space and time. And so different groups going to looking at the atmosphere of Venus, even with the same instruments, might find different answers at different times, because the abundance of this material might be subject to all kinds of processes in the atmosphere of Venus that we don't understand. So a non-detection doesn't definitively rule out that it's not there, but it definitely helps place an upper bound on how much would be there. I'm reminded of a continuing and much longer running debate as to whether or not there's methane on the surface of Mars, because this was a detection originally made by the NASA's Curiosity rover. And in fact, there's a the rover has repeatedly detected very low, small amounts of methane in the atmosphere of Mars near the surface. But in fact, there's a whole spacecraft, the European Space Agency's Trace Gas Orbiter, designed, amongst other things, to search for methane in the Martian atmosphere. And they can't see any of it. And so how do you reconcile that mismatch between what you're getting on the ground with a rover and what you're seeing from space with an orbiter? You know, maybe it's something similar for Venus. Maybe there is a little bit of phosphine there, much less than originally claimed. But maybe the amount changes seasonally or daily or depending on what altitude in the clouds you're talking about. We just frankly don't know. And that's been sort of the kind of almost frustrating thing about this, is that with each of these teams looking at the data and revisiting the data and reanalyzing each other's results, I don't think we're any closer to definitively ruling it in or out.
Well, can we be speculative for a moment, Paul?
You bet. I specialize in this.
Okay. So these initial findings were found kind of in the atmosphere of Venus. The new findings claim that they are a little bit deeper into that planet. But if they were in the atmosphere of Venus, does that mean that if this is because of a life process, this life exists in the clouds of Venus or on the surface?
So I think we can fairly confidently rule out it being on the surface because the conditions there are essentially hell made real. It's the temperature of a self-cleaning oven. It's pressure equivalent to about a half a mile underwater on Earth. It's very hard to imagine anything being alive in those conditions. Certainly life as we know it. However, the Venus atmosphere has long fascinated scientists because at around 40 miles up, the temperature and pressure conditions are very similar to room temperature and pressure conditions on Earth. And so for a long time, dating back certainly to the 60s, scientists have hypothesized at least that there could potentially be some sort of, perhaps not necessarily a biological life form there, but at least the conditions that would support the existence of a life form. Now, we don't know that much about Venus, and we certainly don't know that much about its atmosphere, but we do know that there's very little water at those altitudes and that there's a lot of UV radiation. So even if you consider the temperature and pressure to be okay, there are other reasons why it might be a really difficult place for life to take a foothold. But if the detection of phosphine were found to be true, and if it were found to be in a place where the general environmental conditions are not terrible, then it certainly doesn't rule out the possibility of there being some sort of biological signature producing this on Venus. But I want to emphasize, we have no solid evidence to support this at all. And another way in which phosphine can be produced is through volcanoes. And we do know that Venus abounds with them. Now, we don't know the exact chemical composition of the stuff, that the gases that come out of the volcanoes. And so it's not clear at all that volcanoes could at all account for the phosphine in the atmosphere, assuming it's there in the first place. But in other words, even when speculating, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And so it would be easier to attribute phosphine, if it were there at all, to say volcanic processes or maybe some other weird chemistry we don't understand in the atmosphere than to say biology.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, Paul, is if it's not life, what is this detection doing to help us understand the planet's extreme conditions, as you've foreshadowed?
Right. I think it's certainly helping us understand that we just don't know that much about Venus. We don't really know what the atmosphere is doing. We have a rough idea of what it's made of. In the 60s, 70s, 80s, humankind sent several probes through the atmosphere. In fact, we're actually working on developing a new one now that NASA will fly later this decade. And those probes have told us some important things about what the atmosphere is made of and also how it changes with altitude. But what we've never been able to do is have something live in the atmosphere for a long period of time to be able to tell us how the winds change and whether or not there are upwellings and downwellings, even what kind of weather you get in the middle part of the atmosphere where the clouds are. So we don't know that much about the physical and chemical processes there, which makes it very difficult for us to put this phosphine detection, assuming it's even true, in the context of what might be making it and what might be distributing it and changing its abundances through time. We just don't know enough yet. The real way to get at this question is to get into the Venus clouds.
And are there any plans to do that anytime soon?
So happily, later this decade, NASA is working on a mission called Da Vinci. Da Vinci is one of two missions that NASA picked two summers ago to go back to Venus for the first time in about 40 years. And Da Vinci is a probe that will basically hurtle through the atmosphere from the top of the clouds right down to the ground. It'll take about an hour to do so. It'll also be accompanied by a carrier stage, which will be taking some measurements from orbit. But this probe is basically going to sample the atmosphere at different altitudes. And on the way down, it's going to provide, in the course of simply an hour, some extraordinarily valuable chemical and physical information that will be crucial for us to understand more about the atmosphere. Now, Da Vinci won't be the last word on this. As I say, one of the most important things we could do to try and tackle this question generally is get into the atmosphere. And here I'm thinking of the fact that in the 1980s, the Soviet Union flew two balloons that were able to coast around on the air currents in the atmosphere. And again, about 40 miles up, those balloons lasted for about 2 days each. Now, they were very, very simple, very minimal instrumentation. But those balloons demonstrated that flying a larger, more capable balloon is technically feasible. And if we were able to take the instrumentation, say, that Da Vinci will carry and put it on a balloon and allow that balloon to basically be carried by the winds for weeks or even months, that would go an enormous long way to actually help us definitively answer the question, not just of the phosphine, but about the atmosphere itself.
That's incredible to think about, the fact that in the 80s there was a balloon on Venus, and the fact that we may have this, you know, this Venus blimp in the future, just sampling the atmosphere.
You know, honestly, wouldn't it be amazing? And also, just it's going to be clear, you know, if anyone's ever going to find one of these things, put cameras on it. Those original two balloons the Russians flew, they did not have cameras. So we had very limited information. But I got to tell you, I cannot wait to see what a sunset looks like through the Venus clouds.
With Da Vinci, Paul, will it be looking specifically for evidence of phosphine, or is its importance more in the fact that it can provide those atmospheric variables to help with these Earth-based observations of the phosphine signature? How is it going to help?
It's more the latter. It's providing evidence and information about what the atmosphere is made of and also how it's mixed, which is a big thing that when you look at how atmospheres behave, you need to understand how various layers behave and interact with each other. As of now, Da Vinci is not designed to search for phosphine. And one of the main reason for that is that the Da Vinci probe, although it was selected as a concept for flight in 2021, that was only a few months after the phosphine detection. And at that point, the Da Vinci proposal team had been working on this concept for several years. So teams generally can't pivot that fast to incorporate, say, a new instrument in response to a new discovery. So right now, Da Vinci's primary goal is not to search for phosphine. It's possible that the mission team will decide to focus on that gas, but even if they don't, Da Vinci's still going to return some crucial chemical data we need to better understand how the atmosphere ended up the way it is in the first place.
And finally, Paul Byrne, why is this so important? How is this going to help us understand not only our solar system, but life elsewhere by understanding what's happening at Venus?
So, you know, Brendan, the way I like to tell people about this is that if we are serious about understanding how life arose and how it came to be, say, on our own world, well, we're going to have to understand the rules that govern how large rocky worlds become habitable in the first place. And guess what? There's only one other large rocky world anywhere near us, and it's Venus. It's not Mars, it's not the Moon, it's not Mercury. Those worlds tell us other things. But in terms of telling us how you get a large rocky world to be, Venus is the key. Because something happened in the past that made Venus very, very different to Earth. And we don't know if Venus is the likely outcome of large planets when they grow, or if Earth is. And if we're serious about understanding how it is that Earth has remained habitable for more than 4 billion years and has had life for certainly in excess of 3.5 billion years, the key to understanding whether we're the normal outcome or we're unique is Venus. And so any mission that we send to Venus, be it an orbiter, probe, a balloon, a lander, any mission is going to advance our understanding, not just of Venus, but of the rules that govern large rocky worlds generally, including our own. And with that information, we'd be much better placed to understand whether or not we might find life on other large rocky planets elsewhere in the cosmos.
Well, Paul, for what it's worth, you are helping me understand all of this stuff. So thank you for always coming on the show.
You bet. My pleasure. Thanks, Brendan.
Paul Byrne is an associate professor of Earth, Environmental, and Planetary Sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. Paul, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Still to come, why scientists are stoked about missions to the moon's South Pole. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. For the first time in more than a half century, NASA is sending people back to the lunar surface with its upcoming Artemis missions. They're heading to an area of the moon that scientists are particularly interested in, the South Pole.
Here to talk more about research on the moon and why this area is vital for exploration is NASA planetary scientist Barbara Cohen. Barbara, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So we've been communicating via email to set up this interview, and I noticed in your email signature it says, Dr. Barbara Cohen, lunatic. And I assume that that relates to your passion for the lunar surface, does it not?
In part, of course. You know, it's one of those words that has two great meanings. I actually borrowed that from previous generations of lunar scientists who were involved in Apollo. At Caltech, they ran the Lunatic Lab, which was one of the first labs to do isotope work on the lunar samples. And one of my postdoc advisors also called himself a lunatic. And so it's in broad use in our little sub community. But I think we all have to be a little bit crazy to work in this business as well. It's a constantly changing business that, you know, is really the merger of the science and the passion that we have for the science with the public policy realities of our nation and the human exploration program and what it means to have a human exploration program in America, which is more than just science. So I think it's a little of each.
And that kind of that passion is expanding, as you kind of alluded to there. You know, this is with kind of some of the big headlines that we've seen lately, India landing on the moon, NASA announcing its first crew for Artemis II. There is a bit of moon fever in now the general public to go along with the scientific community. For you, what is so exciting about this moment in time?
Well, we have been hungering for access to the lunar surface for 50 years. The last time that the U.S. had soft landing access to the moon was in 1972, which is the last time we sent humans to the moon. When you look at the success of the Mars rovers, I've been involved in the Mars rover exploration program with, you know, four rovers, and just the amazing success that they have had shows us the power of being on the surface of the planet, of really getting there, having our geologic avatars do field science for us, look at rocks, pick up rocks, analyze the rocks. They tell us the history of the planet in a way that we can't do in the same way from orbit. So touching the surface of a planet is just one of the things that we have so many questions that we can answer. And we haven't been able to do that for the moon for my whole professional career. So we've had this store of scientific samples and science goals, things that were spurred by Apollo, things that have been spurred by our orbital assets since Apollo, that we want answers to, that we're hungry for, that we really want to get to the surface and touch the rocks and take them apart, bring those samples back. So the South Pole is one of those places where we didn't understand the promise that it had during Apollo. We couldn't have gone during Apollo anyway. So this unique kind of confluence of things that allow us to get to the surface and allow us to get to the South Pole is bringing up 50 years of hunger that we want, 50 years of questions we've been trying to answer, and giving us this enthusiasm for being able to get at some of them finally.
And why are you so excited to take a bite out of the South Pole? You mentioned this lunar hunger, but what is so appetizing about what's happening at the South Pole?
The two main things that make the South Pole really interesting for human exploration are its abundance of light and its abundance of water. So its abundance of light means that we can have solar panels generate power for human activities. At the equator, and you know from the Apollo missions that and if you look outside and see the moon, you know that the moon goes around the Earth once every 28 days. That's also its solar cycle and its day. So if you were standing at one place on the equator on the moon and looking out at the sun, local noon when the sun goes directly overhead to local noon when the sun goes directly overhead again, it's 28 terrestrial days. So that means that for 14 days, it's dark. It's night, local nighttime. Local nighttime on the moon means there's no solar energy coming to you. There's no atmospheric scattering. There's no geothermal energy coming up from the moon anymore. Very little geothermal heat coming up from the moon. So it's extremely cold. And so it's very challenging to use engineering assets that go b- people through those hot and cold periods. So going to the poles gives you a little bit more of a clement environment. It's cold, but it's kind of constantly cold. And it doesn't go through those same kind of day-night cycles. There are places on the moon where it may not go through a night cycle for most of the year. And so you can put up solar assets, you can keep your power systems running for a long time. You don't go through 2 weeks of night every month. So that's really attractive for building things, keeping things running on solar energy. But scientifically, the South Pole is where we think there are stores of water and other volatile elements. Volatile elements are things that are gases at room temperature. So things like CO2, carbon dioxide, noble gases like argon, stuff like that, that would be in our atmosphere on the moon. Of course, it has no atmosphere, but it has those constituents frozen out and frozen in places that are very cold that keep those gases sequestered for billions of years. And those gases came to the moon, some from the moon's interior outgassing, but a lot of them came from comets and asteroids impacting the moon over time. That's something that I'm personally interested in. What were the things that were coming into the moon and by extension the Earth throughout the history of the solar system? As the solar system was being built, as things were moving around, what was coming into the Earth-Moon system to make the building blocks for us? Those volatiles are stored at the South Pole. So getting to lick those, getting to bite those, tells us about the way that the solar system was set up for billions of years ago and the way that mixing happened in our solar system. It's recorded at the poles of the moon.
You mentioned that even if we wanted to in Apollo, we couldn't get to this region. What has changed over this half century that's allowing scientists like yourself to get access to this region of the moon?
Well, physics is physics. Physics hasn't changed. So the orbit that we send assets to largely determines how much energy it takes to get to different points on a planet. So if you think about the way that we launch rockets, right, we want launch them from as close to the equator as we can so they get a nice equatorial orbit, or you can launch them in a polar orbit. That determines where you can access. Or how much energy you need to change your plane or to change your orbit to access a point on the surface. So the Apollo missions were set up to have an equatorial orbit. That meant they could access places on the equator and they could get out quickly. So they always had access to an escape route via equatorial, right? So that control module came around on a regular cadence and flew overhead so they could rendezvous with it if they needed to. The way that the Artemis program has set up for access to the poles is by using a different kind of orbit. It's called a near rectilinear halo orbit, and you don't need to know much about it except that it's a different kind of orbit that allows you to come very close to one of the lunar poles on a regular cadence, but that regular cadence is every several days instead of every couple hours the way the equatorial cadence was. So by putting our assets into that orbit, we're able to access the South Pole, and then the assets in that orbit would go away, and then they'd come looping back. And it's a way to get polar access for a stable amount of time. So it's just a different orbit that we chose for our architecture this time.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation how important it was for geological avatars. I think that, is that the term you used? Is that an astronaut? Is that what you're talking about?
No, in that case, I was talking about robots.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you can think of the robots on the surface of Mars, for example, like the Perseverance rover. We operate them as with our eyes, and we get stereo images back. We have an arm that we use to manipulate things on the surface. We used to talk about on the Mars Exploration Rover missions on Spirit and Opportunity, doing the rover dance where we would try to put ourselves in the eyes of the rover and see what happens, right? So they are our avatars. Our crew members, I wouldn't say our avatars, they're members of our science team. So yes, we do see some things through their eyes and they are sending back video and pictures and stuff like that. So yes, that's part of it. But they're also literally members of our science team who are doing the field work. Just like if I sent a field assistant into the field, they are doing the field work. They are doing the science on everyone's behalf. They're collecting samples and they're collecting images and they're collecting data and observations geologic observations that teams on Earth will use for decades to come as well.
And finally, Barbara, I've got to imagine the really exciting thing about having these human astronauts down there, these extensions of or members of your science team out there making these geological assessments and selections is that some of the stuff is coming back, right? I mean, how is that going to change the way you and your colleagues are able to kind of classify this region of the moon by physically having samples from the region back here on Earth?
Samples are literally the gift that keeps on giving. We continue to use the Apollo sample collection to this day. People all over the world, researchers all over the world, request the Apollo samples. It's an active science collection 50 years later, 60 years later. So we have every expectation that samples from the Artemis program is going to be an active science collection for decades to come in its own way. It's a different site from Apollo. There are some real similarities that will allow us to make comparisons and to check some of our assumptions and our models about the moon. And then there are going to be some real differences that are going to give us insight into how the moon formed. How the moon formed is intimately part of how the Earth-Moon system formed. So it has everything to do with how the Earth formed. And in turn, that has everything to do with how our sun and our solar system formed, how all of our planets, our meteorites, our asteroids, how other solar systems are forming right now that assets like JWST are looking at. So rocks from the moon are very, very powerful tracers of big, big processes.
And happening in just a few years from now, right? The excitement that the Artemis missions are happening within the next few years and not the next few decades is got to be, it's exciting for me as a public observer, but I'm sure it's very exciting for you and your colleagues, is it not?
It's extremely exciting for our generation to have this opportunity in front of us. Like I said, we were sort of the torchbearers after Apollo, where we learned from the people who did Apollo. Some of them are still around. Most of them are not around. And so they had to really impart their knowledge to us. And we have had to carry that knowledge and now hopefully act on it. So it's very exciting for us to have this opportunity in front of us, for sure.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Alessandra Bonaiuto. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.